So in the first chapter of Esther, we are introduced to King Xerxes and the extravagance of his empire. He is hosting a huge feast to, as wealthy people tend to do a lot of times, to show off, really, is what he's doing. During the proceedings, and as you can imagine, the wine is flowing, the king, in a moment of pride, commands his queen, Queen Vashti, to come out and appear before the guests. And really, he just wants to show her off. He wants everybody to see how lucky he is, or not lucky, how powerful he is in this woman that is his queen. She refuses. He is not happy. In response, which this is funny, he doesn't just think on his own. He consults his advisors. And there's this allegory thing where his advisors, and it's really kind of, I chuckled a little bit when I remembered and read it. So here's what the advisors say. It's not just her, King. Her disobedience could inspire rebellion among women all over the empire. If she won't listen to you, all of these women won't listen to their husbands. What could happen? So to prevent this, they advise the king to remove her as queen, and then, on top of that, to issue a decree declaring that all women must respect and obey their husbands. He says yes to this, and Queen Vashti is removed. So now, of course, he has no queen, and the search begins for a new one. The king's officials, again, he consults with them, and they suggest that he bring the most beautiful women in the empire, and many of them are brought to the royal palace for preparation, and among those is Esther, a young Jewish woman raised by her cousin Mordecai, and she has hidden her Jewish identity as she has been brought to the palace, but she finds favor with everyone, including the king, who chooses her ultimately as the new queen. Meanwhile, her cousin Mordecai, who has raised her, overhears a plot to assassinate the king. He tells Esther. Esther, in turn, tells the king, and she gives credit to Mordecai. The plot is thwarted, and Mordecai's loyalty is recorded in the royal chronicles, which at the time seems weird, but it's foreshadowing, and we'll get there. There's like this little note. Not only does he do this thing, it's recorded in the history of the royal court kind of thing. The story then kind of takes a little bit of a darker turn because we are introduced to Haman, who is a high-ranking official in the court. He's promoted to a position of even greater power, and the king commands that all officials would bow down to him, but Mordecai refuses to do so because of his faith. I only bow down to God, essentially. This enrages Haman, and rather than just dealing with Mordecai on his own, he actually comes up with a plan to destroy all of the Jewish people in the Persian Empire. He manipulates the king into issuing a command that the Jews will essentially be exterminated, claiming that they are a threat to the distinct customs in Persia. And the decree sets a specific date for the mass execution of all of these people. Letters are sent to every province, and as you can imagine, there is a lot of fear and uncertainty among the Jewish population in the kingdom. At this point, Mordecai re-enters the story, and learning of what is going on, he tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth, and mourns publicly. Jews throughout the empire join in fasting, weeping, and lamenting. Esther is unaware of this issue, of the order that has been issued, and she learns of what Mordecai is in distress and sends a messenger to find out what's wrong. She is told what is going on. And he asks her then to go to the king and plead for people's lives. At first, she is not sure because she's afraid for her own life, because in the court, if you approached the king without being summoned, you could be put to death. Mordecai, of course, challenges her, and we have this very famous passage, which is often quoted from Esther. It may be for such a time as this that you have been called. That's in chapter 4. Esther responds to the call, and she resolves to act, and she asks Mordecai to gather all the Jews in the city and declares, "If I perish, I perish." She puts a plan into action to save her people. After first fasting and preparing herself, she approaches the king unbidden. And even though this could have led to death, the king receives her graciously and asks her what it is that she desires. And he offers up to a half of his kingdom. Esther is playing the long game here. So she says, rather than making any immediate request, why don't you and Haman come to this private banquet that I have prepared? At the banquet, King Xerxes asks her again, what is it that she wants? And she, still playing the long game, says, why don't you all come back tomorrow to another banquet? And I'll tell you what my request is. Haman, of course, in the meantime, is very thrilled by the special attention he's receiving from the queen. Little does he know. But his joy quickly turns to anger as he sees Mordecai again refusing to bow down to him. Fueled by his hatred, Haman decides to build a massive gallows right outside so that Mordecai could be executed the next day. This also is a good bit of foreshadowing. That night, we return, which is a total coincidence, only not obviously. King Xerxes can't sleep. And so he says, you know what? Why don't you get the Royal Chronicles and read them to me? Thinking that will help him sleep. As the records are being read, he is suddenly, out of nowhere, reminded of who Mordecai is and what Mordecai has done for him and the plot that he exposed to assassinate him, and realizes that he had never actually rewarded him for this. So, seeking to rectify this, he asks his advisors what should be done for a man that the king wishes to honor. In a great moment of irony, Haman enters at that time, intending to ask for Mordecai to be executed. Before he can speak, the king interrupts him and says, how do we honor somebody who the king favors? Haman, being clueless as well as arrogant, says, wow, he's talking about me. Well, here's what we'll do. A lavish public display, including dressing that person in royal robes, placing them on a royal horse, and you parade them through the city. To Haman's shock and humiliation, the king says, those are great ideas, and we're going to do all of them for Mordecai. Haman, of course, is even more angry and humiliated, but he is forced to do exactly as the king says. So all of those things happen, and afterwards he returns home in despair. But before he can even process what has happened, he is summoned to Esther's second banquet. At the meal, the king again asks Esther what her request is, saying he will grant it no matter what. Esther then finally reveals the goal of her long game, and that is to plead for the lives of her people and herself, explaining that they have been set to be destroyed. The king, who is also kind of clueless, says, wait, what? What are we talking about? How could that be? Who's behind that? And he finds out, of course, that he has ordered this thing to take place. And the king then, is reminded and told who's behind the plot. And Esther points out Haman sitting at the banquet as the person who has offered all of this. The king is furious, and so he decides to step out into the garden for fresh air. Haman realizes he is in deep, deep water. And so he drops to his knees and is like grabbing the hem of Esther's cloak, begging for his life, and in walks the king, who then interprets that as Haman assaulting her or bothering her, and he becomes even more angry. He then orders Haman to be executed on the spot, and lo and behold, one of the king's servants says, by the way, there's this huge gallows right outside. And it is the case that Haman is then condemned to be hanged on the very gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. He is executed. Queen Esther and Mordecai's fortunes rise. The king gives Haman's estate to Esther, and the king gives Mordecai the royal signet ring that once belonged to Haman, and it symbolized his new authority. However, there's this little thing going on. Despite the fact that Haman is dead, the edict about killing all of the Jews has already been issued. And Persian law says that that cannot be changed. So Esther bravely approaches the king yet again and pleads for him to issue a new decree to save her people. He agrees and he writes a new edict, not canceling the other one, but the new decree permits the Jews to defend themselves against any attack against them on the day that was set, the day and time. The decree is sent throughout the empire and the Jewish people rejoice. Mordecai is honored and dressed in royal robes, and the fear of the Jews spreads, with many people in the empire supporting them now. The dramatic conclusion of the story then unfolds as the Jews prepare to defend themselves against their enemies on the designated day. But because of the new decree, the Jewish people are empowered to fight back, and on that appointed day, they gather in their community and indeed successfully defend themselves, striking down those who had sought to harm them. In particular, in the city of Susa, Esther and Mordecai request an additional day of fighting, which is granted. The Jews in Susa kill several of their enemy, including all 10 of Haman's sons. Throughout the empire, they celebrate their victory and establish the Feast of Purim to commemorate their deliverance from destruction. Mordecai then sends letters to all Jewish people, instructing them to celebrate this annually and remember the events of their deliverance and give gifts to one another and to the poor. The very last chapter is about 4 or 5 verses long. It mentions, first of all, that King Xerxes then imposes tributes on the land and talks about the greatness of his rule, and then notes that Mordecai, who now, of course, holds a high royal position in the court, is being honored or has been honored for his wisdom and leadership, and that his deeds have been recorded in history. And the final verse of this story emphasizes the profound respect and honor Mordecai receives among the Jewish people and his efforts to promote their welfare and speak for their well-being. So that is the drama and the story of Esther. It's worth noting that the festival established in this story is still celebrated. It's characterized by joy and feasting, the giving of gifts. Usually there is also a presentation of a play based on this tale. It's often done by children. And as a matter of fact, during the dramatic readings, people are often dressed in costumes, and they even participate. It's a participatory thing. They boo and hiss and cheer at different points in the narrative in the play as the drama is unfolding. And it is a reminder and celebrating deliverance. One of the great things about Scripture that I have found over my lifetime is no matter how many times you hear a story or read a story, you can learn something from it. And before I talk a little bit more about some of the lessons that are traditionally known, I kind of came across in reading commentaries a new lesson, I would call it, from Esther that I want to share. And I thought it was really good. A commentator pointed this out. Esther's actions in this story do indeed save the day, right? They save the Jewish people, but they lead to more fear, right? The people in Persia don't end up fearing God, they end up fearing the Jews. Esther's request that her people be spared doesn't lead to lasting peace. It doesn't essentially, totally revoke the royal death warrant. It just causes more death in a different way. And it really causes a little mini civil war, which Israel survives by killing its enemy. Even in victory, the life remains precarious, and it's tied to conventional power. And the commentator goes on to say, as long as a people's fate rests upon worldly power, it's insecure. Xerxes answers the queen's request with temporary relief, but God answers her implicit prayer ultimately with a son in Jesus Christ, whose name stands forever above heaven and earth and grants a reprieve not just from the latest generation of death, but a Passover that delivers from all sin and death. I don't know that I had ever read this story as an allegory for reminding us that an eye for an eye really does leave everybody blind. even though the Jews are saved, they end up killing a bunch of people. And as we know, it's one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. And they do it in preservation and in defense. But we are reminded that violence begets violence begets violence, and ultimately really doesn't solve anything other than causing more violence. And in addition to that, I think we're reminded that we obviously live in this world, in this county, in this city, in this country. And so there are things that we follow because we are citizens. But ultimately, this story also reminds us that our values, who we are, our core, is supposed to be founded on our faith, not necessarily our political party or our job or, you know, anything else. That as followers of God and followers of Christ, ultimately the big decisions that we make in our lives are supposed to be influenced by our faith. Worth remembering. Esther is known as a very kind of famous story in the Bible, not just because it's about a woman or involves a woman, but because if you have ever read the book, you will notice not once in all of the 10 chapters is the word God actually used. No place is God specifically mentioned. And while it's kind of weird in a way that it's included in Scripture when God isn't mentioned, I'm not sure that ultimately that's a bad thing. You have heard me say this before, and I will say it again this morning. The older that I get, the more hesitant I am, and the more careful I think we should be about using the phrase, the will of God. I think that that phrase is tossed around casually. I think that phrase is absolutely tossed around ignorantly at times. God is always at work, yes, absolutely, foundational thing of our faith. But this narrative, this story, refuses to either trivialize that presence or trivialize the difficult work and the moral agents that are going on in the story by pointing and ascribing everything to the transparent will of God in history. If we're honest, isn't this kind of thing often true in our lives and in our world? Certainly, I think, and I can point to, if I tell my faith story, there are specific times in my life where I can say, this was from God, and I believe that. But there are so many more times in my life where I can say, I'm not sure, right? This ultimately turned out well, but I don't know. And again, the older I get, the more hesitant I am to just put my finger down and say, God, universally. So often, I think in our own lives and in our own world, we have to look and make decisions and use the brain that God gave us, as well as our heart, when we're discerning where God is and what's going on. In the everyday actions and realities of life, we often probably wish for God's direct intervention, a burning bush like Moses got, or an obvious miracle. But if we're honest, a lot of days, most days probably, we don't get that, do we? Most of the time, as somebody mentioned in writing about this passage, a friend says, God is subtle to a fault. And yet, if we have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, we might be able to discern where God is acting in our lives. There's an old saying that somebody put a twist on, a coincidence is a miracle in which God prefers to remain anonymous. A coincidence is a miracle in which God prefers to remain anonymous. So part of what we are doing with our faith and with our eyes and with our hearts and with our minds is actively looking and trying to discern where God is in our lives and in the world. Frederick Buechner says, the question is not whether the things that happen to you are chance things or God's things, because of course, they're both at once. There's no chance thing through which God cannot speak. God speaks, I believe, and the words he speaks are incarnate in the flesh and blood of ourselves and of our own footsore and sacred journeys. Be not afraid, for lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. He says he is with us on our journeys. God says he has been with us since each of our journeys began. Listen for him. Listen to the sweet and bitter airs of your present and your past for the sound of God. Commentators will tell you that this story is in the Bible for a number of reasons, but one of those is that it is a story of hope. As we look at this story and as we think and talk about hope, I want to take a moment, though, to talk again about how we throw around that phrase, the will of God, and how it has different meaning in different people's lives for different reasons. A commentator said, those of us who live in a time and a place where we are free to use God's name publicly and privately, both reverently and flippantly, quickly forget that such freedom is not a gift given to everyone. Throughout our world and throughout human history, there are entire populations who must trust that though God cannot be named, God is at work to put things right, to deal justly with both the oppressor and the oppressed. Not too long ago, as is my habit, I turned on the NPR does a little news summary in the mornings that I can get through one of my apps. And it's basically like five things that are going on in the world. And that day I happened to hear about Sudan. And it's always interesting to me how news is communicated in our world. And I'm not going to go down that road, but it's amazing to me in hearing this story and then doing a little bit of research, what is going on in a place and how little I've heard about it. And boy, given all of the nonsense going on in the election, there are much more things important that I would rather have heard about than some of the stuff I have. So on April 15th, 2023, violent clashes erupted between the Sudanese army, essentially, and a paramilitary group called the RSF in Sudan. Y'all, half, not a third, not a fourth, half of Sudan's population, 25 million people, now need humanitarian assistance and protection. The country is facing extreme shortages of food, water, medicine, and fuel, and more than half the population are facing acute food insecurity, including 8.5 million at emergency level. In the last month, 430 people died from cholera. The health ministry says that the total number of infections has risen to about 14,000. 14,000 people with cholera. More than 10 million people have been displaced. That includes 8 million people who have been displaced within the country and 2 million people who fled to neighboring countries. This puts some perspective on what we're talking about, right? Easy for us, I think, to flippantly talk about God here and God there, and that's not to say that we're always wrong. But where is God for somebody who is literally, and I've read other and heard other reports, literally living in hell on earth right now? That becomes a little more challenging when we think about our faith and how it plays out in the world. Which is not to say God is not present in Sudan, we know better. But it is to think about the language we use and how we use, and I will say again, as I have said a million times, and will say a million times more, words matter. Language has power. Part of this story is a reminder that God never, ever abandons God's people. No matter how bad things get for the Jews under the hand of King Xerxes, God is still God, and God never abandons them. It's a strong theme through post-exilic literature and with Esther too. The story is partly included in the Bible to give those Jews living in whatever sort of exile where they were, support and courage where they were. Stories like this one were needed to lift up sagging spirits and to offer heroes and heroines to arise from time to time in order to save scattered people. Exiles need hope, and Esther offers hope. I think we are aware now that it's not just exiles that need hope. We all need hope at times in our lives. Part of this story reminds us again that God is always present, But sometimes we also have to be active in looking for hope in the world around us. I want to close this message today by offering a prayer that was in one of the commentaries I was reading that was kind of a response to the whole story. I think it's an appropriate reminder and a way to do that, and a reminder of our relative privilege as we sit in this sanctuary, because of course, as we know, it's not just the Sudan. People in the Ukraine, people in places that we don't even know about, do not have the freedoms that we do and are suffering in ways that we are not. Loving God, there are those who are not free to name your name. Be known to them. Be known to them as you made yourself known in Esther's time, remembering the forgotten and saving those who were pawns in the games of the powerful. Amen.